The Dominion Arsenal owes much of its existence to the efforts of Victoria County Bombastic Member of Parliament, Sam Hughes. Sir Sam, after he was knighted in, I think it was 1915. Hughes, a former school teacher, had been preoccupied with building up Canada's position as a major military and industrial force within the British Empire. Among his projects was the building of new drill halls across the country, one of which was our own Victoria Park Armory here in Lindsay. The armory, which replaced the drill hall dating back to the aftermath of the Fenian Raids, opened in 1913. The following summer, Archduke Franz Ferdinand was assassinated, and what became known as the Great War of Civilization, as I said earlier, was underway. Though more or less a self-governing dominion within the British Empire, Canada was at war as soon as the United Kingdom was, and the quest to supply the Canadian Expeditionary Force with ammunition was on. Indeed, between 1914 and 1918, almost 540 industrial factories across the country, mostly steel plants, were taken over by the federal government and converted for the purposes of wartime production. The Steel Company of Canada, Stelco, for example, refocused its energies on shell manufacture, and its Brantford and Montreal plants would eventually turn out a staggering 1,312,616 shells in 1918 alone. We might marvel at this organization and efficiency of war production, but it was not always so. For the first year or so of the conflict, wartime production in Canada was marred by political patronage, scandals, and inefficiency. And a lot of this was laid at the feet of the aforementioned Sir Sam Hughes, surprise, surprise. Perhaps the most infamous example of Hughes' lack of leadership was the Ross Rifle. And show of hands, some of you are familiar with that story. Yeah, you're good. Ever the nationalist, Hughes insisted on supplying Canadian soldiers with Canadian-made weaponry, and the Ross had been manufactured in Quebec City since 1902. Yet the rifle invented by Sir Charles Ross had a reputation for jamming with mud, hardly a sort of weapon suitable for trench warfare. The Ross rifle was the greatest crime ever perpetrated against the soldier boys and their loved ones, declared the Reverend Canon Frederick Scott, a Canadian Army chaplain. And he continued, "The blood of Canadians wasn't worth the filthy gold that somebody made out of it." Permitting his own nationalism to dictate the procurement of a dangerous and inefficient rifle was just one of Hughes' political blunders during this period. Not long after the war broke out, Hughes asked Thomas Alexander Russell, founder of the Toronto-based Russell Motor Car Company, to take on responsibility for building and procuring armored trucks for the Canadian Army. Now, it just so happened that one of Sir Sam Hughes' most loyal and fervently partisan supporters was a senior executive on the Russell team, James H. McCory, a native of Argyle, in Hamilton Township, was 33 years old and was employed as Russell's senior-most salesman, traveling across the country and setting up dealerships for the company. Conflict of interest? You bet. Not surprisingly, the Liberal opposition cried foul about this blatant use of political patronage. Said a Liberal-produced brochure entitled War Scandals, and I quote, "Mr. McCory is well known as a protege and political henchman of the Minister of Militia. At one time, he was a lay preacher. At another, he was a chauffeur. But he was always a strong helper of the Major General, Hughes, at election times in his riot. When the war broke out, McCory appeared on the scene as a motor truck agent and sold the department 8 trucks manufactured by the Russell Motor Truck Car Company at $1,650 each, equal to $13,200, for which he admitted he received a commission, probably 10%. Thomas Russell, general manager of the Russell Motor Company, and McCory were then appointed by the Minister of Militia as per the following letter, dated August 14, 1914. This is from Sam Hughes to Thomas Alexander Russell and James H. McCory. Dear sirs, I have the pleasure in commissioning you to select for me, for the Department of Militia and Defense, using your best judgment, as many mortar trucks as you can conveniently secure, up to 25 to be delivered at Valcartier, Quebec, by the end of 2 weeks from today, the 28th. I shall be obliged if you will also supply the chauffeurs for these trucks, faithfully signed Sanders, P.S. also suitable trailers. And that note was copied on to Messrs. Russell and McCrory at the Chateau Laurier in Ottawa. Full disclosure, Mr. McCrory's great niece is my mother. I told this story, though, to demonstrate the extent to which wartime production and procurement was haphazard and often benefited a select few businesses and individuals who just happened to travel in Sir Sam's circles, like my great granduncle in the middle of the picture there. Hughes was forced out as a minister of the crown in 1916 and replaced as head of the Imperial Munitions Board, which in turn was created to replace the dysfunctional Shell Committee, of which Hughes was nominally in charge. And he was replaced with the dynamic and far-sighted Peterborough-born businessman Sir Joseph Clavel. Under Clavel's leadership, the IMD reorganized production, vastly improved efficiency, and established a variety of facilities across the country. Bob Armstrong, who knows a thing or two about supply management, I think. So among the factories that were organized and set up by the Imperial Munitions Board were Canadian Aeroplanes Limited in Toronto, the British Cordite Limited in Nobel, Ontario, and the British Munitions Supply Company Limited in Verdun, Quebec. Other munitions plants were operated under the auspices of the Dominion Arsenal. Established in 1882 to provide the Canadian militia with ammunition, this federally run manufacturing business would have two locations by the end of 1918. The original plant was located in Quebec City and had been in operation for over 30 years by the time war broke out. Even so, demand for bullets and shells had increased significantly within a year, and a second arsenal would soon be required. Although Sam Hughes was in significant political trouble by the summer of 1916, the atmosphere in Lindsay at the time was one of tremendous patriotic enthusiasm. That May, the 109th Battalion of Victoria and Haliburton counties had received its regimental colors from Lady Flora McRae Eaton before proceeding overseas. A group of young women graduated the following month from Ross Memorial Hospital's nursing program, including our friend Katie McKinnon, and would soon be shipping out to casualty curing stations and various military hospitals in France and England. And rumors were swirling around town about a small arms plant that would transform the local economy forever. On July 14, 1916, yes, the same day in which Louis Lenny lost his life to shelling in Belgium, readers of the Lindsay Post happened upon the following headline, which blared, "Lindsay secures big ammunition factory, will be in operation by September 16th. The story went on to describe how the factory would benefit Lindsay and the surrounding area, placing its opening in a broader context of a changing economic landscape. And I quote, "The plant will mean much to the inhabitants of the two counties as it will give employment to a large number of persons from the two counties and comes at an opportune time, just as the lumbering industry is nearing its end, and those released from such industry will now receive employment in the new government plant, which will be in operation in a few months' time." Careful readers would have learned from this story that Lindsay had been selected as the site on account of its abundant electrical energy. In a foresighted move, the town had acquired a local power plant a few years before, thus enabling it to provide the 1,500 horsepower and more requisite for the arsenal. They would also have read about the men who would be instrumental in bringing the Dominion arsenal to Lindsay. While Hughes undoubtedly took most of the credit, the local arrangements committee consisted of a who's who of well-connected Lindsay businessmen. These included John Carew, a member of provincial parliament, J.D. Favell, William Favell, Dr. Halpine, H.B. Black, Mayor Bert McLean, J.A. Williamson, and Thomas H. Stinson. Together, these gentlemen have been engaged in negotiations with the federal government for 8 months or more, and have taken innumerable trips up to Ottawa to confer with authorities there about the project. Despite Hughes' well-documented insistence on procuring Canadian-made firearms, the contract for building the arsenal of Lindsay went, ironically, to an American firm. Westinghouse Church and Kerr, based in New York, was a noted designer of industrial complexes. With a history dating back to the 1880s, their resume included the J.I.K. Threshing Machine Company in Racine, Wisconsin, the Rock Island Arsenal Buildings in Rock Island, Illinois, which are pictured here, and on this side of the border, the American Steinmetz Company, located in Niagara Falls, Ontario, and the Northwestern Brass Company of Calgary, Alberta. Trade literature issued by the firm in 1910 emphasized quality workmanship. And I quote, "Well done is better than well said," that was their motto. And no effort was spared in making sure that this goal was lived out in practice. The Westinghouse Church Curve organization is so complete that we offer our client whatever service he needs, whether it be the technical ability of experienced engineers or the production of a complete plant ready for work, they assured prospective clients. Those overseeing the arsenal project in Lindsay were clearly won over by Westinghouse Church Curve. And before too long, some 400 to 500 personnel will be descending into Lindsay to build the biggest industrial facility ever erected in town to date. On July 15, 1916, the day after enemy shells had rained down a convoy in which Lewis Lenny was traveling, his fellow Lindsayites gathered to lay the cornerstone of a plant expressly designed to manufacture weapons with which to kill said enemies. The ceremony was a magnificent one, complete with a monster parade of dignitary bearing automobiles heading to the arsenal grounds, led off by the band of the 109th Battalion. "We Canadians are a peace-loving people," declared Mr. Cinnamon, the master of ceremony's favorite patron. "But the best way to prepare for peace is to be prepared for war. With arsenals, such as the one that is to be built in Lindsay, the country will be better able to perpetuate peace than ever before." There's no irony in that statement at all. While a number of munitions factories were photographed during the First World War, few images survive of the interior of the Dominion arsenal here in Lindsay. There are likely a number of reasons for this, not least for reasons of security. Fortunately, the manufacturing processes and operations that transpired here were recounted in local newspapers and occasionally in the vivid recollections of former munitions workers. A detailed account of the arsenal's inner workings appeared in the August 24, 1917 edition of the Lindsay Post, and I quote, "The word arsenal suggests something imposing, but a visitor going to this place expecting to see a huge pile of buildings would be disappointed. Except the offices, the whole place is unpretentious in appearance, the workshops being one story in height, constructed of brick and steel. Of course, the plant is fireproof throughout, the one danger in this connection being from lightning. And guarded against that, every machine is grounded. The shops contain hundreds of machines, especially designed for the work. There is a gas plant that supplies fuel to the annealing ovens, if I have that pronounced properly. A 600-yard underground range with unique equipment installed for testing purposes. And another range of 180 yards is used for experimental work. Sufficient land to be acquired to extend the plant at any time." Here are a couple of not very great grade photos showing the inside of the arsenal, probably in the mid-1920s. According to the unnamed correspondent who vicariously took Lindsay Post readers through the arsenal, exactly 52 separate operations went into the making of a server cartridge. So copper, nickel, copper, zinc, lead, and aluminum was received in a raw state, heated and rolled into strips. Brass had to be annealed by heat, while nickel was drawn cold. And there was a trained chemist and metallurgist on site, and they were responsible for ensuring that there were no defects in the chemical structure of the metals being used in this part of the process. The cartridge case was manufactured by stamping small discs out of the metal strips, which were then pressed into cup-like pulp shapes and drawn through a machine three times before being annealed in a gas furnace. Then holes for the cap were pressed out and two firing holes were punched into the case. Why two firing holes, you might ask? Well, apparently the three holes were accidentally punched, an explosion could be caused by the damage to the rifle, and if only one hole was punched, the gun would misfire. In making the cap, the percussion compound was pressed into a weight of 600 pounds to a square inch, then dried in a vacuum oven. And because the fulminate that used in the making of cartridges could explode while drying, the oven was built from iron and shaped like a large barrel, with both ends attached to springs, and these would absorb the force of the explosion and mitigate injury to either the machine or its operator. The machinery installed in the Canadian arsenal was described as having, quote, almost human ingenuity with a measure of accuracy that is humanly impossible. One of these machines, operated by a young woman known colloquially as a Blue Devil because of the uniforms they wore, or a munition hand, loaded cordite into the bullets. The cordite was fed out of enormous spools 50 feet in diameter and enclosed in concrete cabinets. It passed through a small hole, was duly measured, cut off, and fitted into the case before being burnished to prevent the charge from being spoiled by moisture. Thereafter, the bullet was tightly crimped and sent off for inspection in another part of the plant. A number of crucial experiments were also carried on at this property bordered by Mary and Albert Streets. These included chemical and metallographic tests, tensile strength and elasticity tests, and firing tests which transpired in the underground rifle range. Pumped up by patriotic fervor and wanting to do their best, everyone seemed to be excited about the new arsenal. Throughout, there is no guesswork and pains have been taken in designing the plant, but the people of Canada may be proud in the knowledge that the Dominion Lindsay Arsenal today represents the latest word in small arm ammunition, Josh, the Lindsay Post correspondent, in his August 24th article. Among the staff, he continued, there are many women who take pride in its growing efficiency and are giving the same enthusiastic service that is characteristic of the women workers in munitions plants in other parts of the country and the allied nations. In 1993, so 30 years ago, the National Film Board released a documentary titled And We Knew How to Dance. Directed by Maureen Judge, this film profiled a dozen women aged 86 to 101 years old who had served in various capacities during the First World War and who were interviewed a few years before, probably about 1990. Among the elderly war workers featured in And We Knew How to Dance was a lady by the name of Elva Cooper. Though it's not explicitly stated in the film, if you can watch the film, and I highly recommend that you do, pay close attention to Elva's recollections, accompanied by the footage filmed on location at what was then known as Trent Rubber. And it's pretty obvious that what we're listening to are the memories of a lady who worked at the Dominion Arsenal in Lindsay during the First World War. Elva recalled in that film, and I quote, when this opportunity came to go to the arsenal, I thought maybe I'd be going out into the world a bit. So I went. I was quite happy I did. I liked the arsenal, and when I went down there, I was shy as all get out. I never knew anything about electricity. I was going down the hall one day, One of the men thought he had some fun with me. He turned on a motor. He thought he was going to scare me. And I just looked straight ahead as if I knew what I was doing. As if I knew all about it. The joke was on him, not on me. Sometimes I got lucky and had a chap ask me to go to a show. You know, at that Academy Theater, when I was there, it was real people who did the show. It wasn't a movie. Some shows I saw anyway with boyfriends, and the shows were good. So this is a lady who, when she was not working at your arsenal, obviously went up the street here and took it as an entertainment at the Academy. Elva Cooper was one of several hundred women who worked at the Canadian Arsenal over the last 2 years of the war. By August of 1917, only a little over a year after the Arsenal opened for business, applications were pouring in from as far away as Ottawa. House famine threatens Lindsay, declared one headline, as Arsenal leadership went before civic authorities asking for at least 400 houses to be built in the interest of accommodating all of these workers. Applicants that accepted would find good rooming and boarding accommodation in Victoria County town, and reasonably good pay, according to the chief recruiting officer, one Major G.I. Campbell. That was reported in the Post on August 24, 1917. Major Campbell, it was stated, was working with a group of ladies on finding housing for this massive influx of munitions workers. And Campbell himself was quoted in the Peterborough Examiner as follows. We expect to send 25 women from Kingston and Ottawa within the next week or 10 days, and as satisfactory arrangements can be made for their housing, we will continue to forward them until the need is supplied. Lindsay and the district around it have provided 260 women for the arsenal, and at least 100 more in the years. Among the local women signing up was Miss Vera Humphrey of Dunsford. As reported in the Post, Vera, who was not quite 20 years old at the time, has decided to do her bit by accepting a position at the Dominion Arsenal, Lindsay. Others of our young women expect to do likewise in the near future. One of these was Miss L.K. Lamb, who had born in Lindsay and then returned to Dunsford, likely by train, for the occasional weekend visit with her parents. Of course, women weren't alone in doing their bit at the arsenal. Among the gentlemen who found work at the arsenal by December of 1917, when some of them were called up for service, were William Cannon, who served as a clerk, James Tyrestone and Lewis Phillip, who were both toolmakers, and Robert Kinnear, Leonard McClellan, and Wilbert Press, all serving as machinists. As with the women, the men came from beyond Lindsay. Charles Dayton of Little Britain, whose daughter Maud was serving as a nursing sister in France, joined his fellow Mariposa Township President George Mark in taking a job at the arsenal that year. Even so, the sheer number of women represented in Canada's munitions factories, both here in Lindsay and elsewhere, and in other wartime roles, including ambulance drivers, farmerettes, nursing sisters, and so forth, represented an historic turning point. Women demonstrated that they were just as capable, if not more so, of working in sectors that were previously the domain of men. Change was coming. Starting with nursing sisters in 1917, suffrage was eventually granted to women at the federal level in 1918. Overseeing the men and women employed at the Dominion Arsenal was one Lieutenant Colonel Cynthia S. Weatherby, who served as superintendent from 1916 through the cessation of hostilities in 1918. A native of Georgetown, Prince Edward Island, Weatherby was born on April 28, 1876. At the tender age of 14, Weatherby went to a summer training camp in Charlottetown with the number 3 company of the 4th Regiment of the PEI Artillery. And he would go on to have a career in the military that would span the World War, the First World War, and the Second World War. Weather Green was the first Canadian chosen to take the highly competitive Master of Drummers course through England's Ordnance College, and he was later appointed as the Royal Canadian Ordnance Corps First Staff Officer. So he rose up through the ranks pretty quickly. Peter left in Lindsay midway through 1916 after a stint as superintendent of the Canadian Arsenal's older plant in Quebec City. I reported at the Arsenal on the 4th of August 1913, just 365 days before World War I began, whether you recall this time in Quebec. Without knowing it, we were to have a full year to prepare for the new manufacturing methods, which were to be the standard used for making Canadian ammunition used in Europe from 1915 to the end of the war. Strangely, Weatherby's recollections of his wartime service, which he wrote down in 1956 in a letter to military historian Colonel C.P. Stacey, made no mention whatsoever of his time in Lindsay. We do know, however, that he and his family were lived in comparative luxury in a large government-owned house at the southwest corner of Mary and Lindsay Streets, opposite the Dairy Queen today. A commodious play building, this house sported two floors, spacious rooms for entertaining dignitaries, a sun porch, and even foot-operated buttons designed to summon servants into the dining room. A tunnel linked the basement of the Arsenal superintendent's residence with the plant a few blocks to the west. On May 16, 1918, Weatherby and his staff had the honor of greeting the Duke and Duchess of Devonshire, then serving as the Governor General of Canada and Vice-Regal Consort, when they made a very brief stop at the Arsenal while visiting Lindsay. 6 months later, with the war over, Weatherby moved on to other duties that took him across Canada, and during the Second World War, his reputation as the father of Canadian munitions saw him being taken on by the Department of Munitions and Supply as an advisor on the manufacture of brass cartridges. And then he died, Weatherby did, in 1958 at the age of 82. As men and women from across Victoria County and around the province took up work at the Arsenal between 1916 and 1918, the place became a hopping hive of activity with a curious mix of characters overseeing the operation, including Colonel Weatherby. Stories about them no doubt found their way over the fence surrounding the property and into the public consciousness. Something reflected in Alice Cassin's poem, A Ballad from Bonneville. And Cassin was a retired railwayman, sporting enthusiast, and amateur poet. And he wrote to the Twitter verse on February 15, 1917. So apart from describing some of the senior Arsenal leadership in kind of a cheeky way, A Ballad from Bonneville also describes the logistical challenges involved in feeding the Arsenal's enormous staff. The dining hall on site measured 30 by 50 feet, and according to kitchen coordinators George McFadden and Lewis Manning, 60 pounds of sausage were consumed at breakfast, 2 quarters of beef, each 150 pounds, were devoured at lunch and supper, while, and I quote, 2 bags of potatoes are used each day, they must be pretty big bags, 40 loaves of bread, and 100 pies, besides cakes and pastries to no end. Note the 1916 story in the Washington Border. Those fellows and women, I guess, were very well fed. So now I quote from Alice Cassin's poem, A Ballad from Bonneville. So think about the people working at the Arsenal as a jurist. It's kind of a fun poem to read. There's a quartet at the Arsenal who are bound to make it go. The boss is Colonel Weatherby, who many of us know. The chemist, Dr. McIntyre, hooks up with Colonel Bell. They're working now upon a lawn below the hounds to hell. Sid Miller, the accountant, keeps the books and data straight, and for his recreation then, at night, he goes to state. He's just fresh from the Capitol, an expert in his line, and hails the day for which we pray when Britons cross the Rhine. Then we have Professor Walters, whom so many ladies know, and wonder if he's married or is looking for a hoe. They know he's an inspector of a dignified degree, And Lot's would like to land her if he's single, don't you see? Cab Maple and Fred Holdsworth went, each with a dog and gun, away back north to Shandos, took possession of the run. They heard the branches breaking, saw a deer rush from the bar, bang bang like both the rifles, but they only shot the dog. The provider, George Mackay, he was always on the job, his busy night and morning, finding grub to fill the guard. His venue would do credit to the best equipped hotel. 3 times a day they come his way and answer to the bell. They just have pork on Sundays now, the price has gone so high. The farmers keep them in the house instead of in the sty. There'll be no more sun handwiches, but still will surely squeal as they're coming into market in a farmer's automobile. Sometimes he kills a sheep or two, sometimes he kills a bull. Sometimes he kills a rooster, that is pretty hard to pull. Sometimes he kills a little calf, sometimes a great big steer. But whether it be small or large, they make it disappear. He has turkey in the hen house, he has ducks and drakes for more, with big bins of potatoes and orders in for more. There isn't any wonder, as his warders pass him by, they smile the smile that won't come off and raise their Christmas high. Someday when it's completed, if we don't protect it right, we'll fancy we're in Flanders in the thickest of the fight. For there will be one awful bang with rafters in the air, with passengers astride them who didn't pay their fare. This last stanza may be an allusion to the dangers of working in the Dominion Arsenal. Indeed, it is a testament to just how solidly built the place was, that it was not consumed by fire or explosion before the end of the war, and would remain an imposing presence in Lindsay for nearly 90 years thereafter. So well constructed and vast were the arsenal buildings that the question of just what to do with them after they ceased production for the first time in 1921 was something that perplexed local authorities. By 1922, they were largely silent and were being used for storage. While much of the machinery that had come their way during the war was packed up and moved to the arsenal's sister plant in Quebec City, some 688 tons of bituminous coal remained in storage at the Lindsay facility. And owing to a coal shortage that left some of Lindsay's larger industrial concerns scrambling, the offer of various types and sizes of coal being kept in the arsenal was certainly gratuitous. For $9 a ton, companies such as the Beale Leather Company, the Carew Lumber Company, and the Horn Brothers Woolen Mill would benefit from the black diamonds left over from the arsenal's halcyon days. And coal wasn't the only thing to be found at the arsenal. A report issued in 1922 noted that there were vast quantities of the infamous Ross rifle stockpiled in the plant. Various suggestions were put forth about what to do with the property. Richard Kiley, who I believe was formerly the mayor of Lindsay, felt that the federal government needed to, quote, advertise this splendid manufacturing plant in the trade journals of the United States in the hopes of enticing someone to buy up the plant and start manufacturing. In 1927, an editorial in the Lindsay Daily Post suggested that the government might be pressured into opening up the arsenal for the purpose of manufacturing airplanes. Nothing came from this proposal, and the plant remained silent. Or if there were maybe the airplanes, yet that plan didn't take off. To put it through. Another decade passed, with the powers that be in Ottawa more or less agreeing to keep the arsenal in reserve in the event that the facilities were needed again. That time came in 1939, when war was once more declared. Uniformed guards took up positions around the arsenal, and the machinery began to come away as it had over 2 decades before. Once again, people from all over Victoria County and beyond found work in the manufacturing of small arms and ammunition for the Canadian military. In September of 1945, Dominion Arsenal's Quebec City and Lindsay plants were reorganized under a new Crown corporation called Canadian Arsenals Limited. Overseeing the operation by this point in time was Colonel Shields, and for another 18 years, the plant, the Lindsay plant, remained one of the area's largest employers. Prospects looked promising, but all of that changed in the opening weeks of 1963. Some of you, if you've been in town long enough, may remember this. In what appears to be a classic case of government cutbacks, the Deputy Minister of Defense Production issued a memo to the town of Lindsay that read, in part, and I quote, "Canadian Arsenals Limited will soon be forced to place Lindsay Arsenal into a standby condition, retaining only sufficient personnel to maintain the facilities." To retain the Lindsay Arsenal meant that there would be a sharply declining employment level in maintaining a facility for which a requirement could not be justified, and which cost the taxpayers of Canada several hundreds of thousands of dollars per year. These government people use run on sentences or something awful. The arsenal closed for good back on July 31st, 1963. And as in the 1920s, municipal leaders did everything in their power to mitigate the effects of unemployment and set out to entice a business or businesses to come to Lindsay and set up shop in the vacant arsenal buildings. Their efforts were met with success, and by 1965, the Firestone Tire and Rubber Company had found a home in the enormous plant. 4 years later, French Rubber took over the operation and remained there for another 35 years. Specializing in rubber inner tubes for tires, Trench Rubber was acquired by parent company Polystar in 1974, before company employees assumed almost full ownership in 1978. In less than a decade, the company's payroll was reaching almost 150 people. 200,000 square feet of space, where 260 women had turned out munitions 70 years earlier, were now being used to manufacture rubber products, both inner tubes and a synthetic loop membrane. Not only was Trent Rubber a success story insofar as it represented a clever use of a former factory site, it was also considered to be one of the country's most progressive companies in terms of corporate structure and organization. So progressive, in fact, that apparently its employees weren't even unionized. As journalist Martin Dewey pointed out in the February 11, 1980 edition of the Globe and Mail, quote, "The plant is a topsy-turvy place where textbook distinctions between capitalist and worker have been blurred beyond recognition." Dewey's readers discovered that of the 132 men and women who worked there, 85% are current owners of the operation, some of them convinced that they are pioneering a new kind of industrial democracy. Karl Marx, Dewey remarked, quote, "would have had an attack of vertigo within a mile of the place." And Mr. Marx and his followers would indeed have looked kindly on how Trent Rubber operated. Of the company's nine-person board, three members were elected from the factory floor. Company president David Kay proudly told the Globe and Mail at the time that this arrangement led to increased productivity, and chairman of the board, George Plummer, optimistically added that, "I have no doubt that the next generation of capitalism will involve employee participation. If you want people to be responsible, you must give them ownership." Profit sharing had been one of Trent Rubber's corporate values from its inception, along with a self-financed sick pay plan and promotion from within employee ranks. Trent Rubber was, in its heyday, entirely locally owned. Said machinist Fred Coffey in an interview with the Globe and Mail reporter, Dewey, "Nobody can come and say they're closing it down and moving it somewhere else. This is a Lindsay plant owned and operated by Lindsay people." But the end was in sight. A perfect storm of factors, including corporate reorganization, fluctuating global oil prices, the low Canadian dollar, and the fact that vehicles were increasingly being fitted with tubeless tires, saw Trent Rubber liquidate its operations midway through 2005. Long-time employees were unceremoniously given their pay slips by upper management, and the site fell silent once more. Shortly thereafter, the Beckham Walls reduced the enormous Blessing House Kerr and church-designed buildings to rubble, and for well over a decade, remnants of broken bricks, bits of twisted metal, and immense concrete foundations lay in the silence of the windswept grass. Farther east, a few heavily overgrown depressions in the ground, a short distance south of James Street, indicates the location of long-forgotten arsenal infrastructure. You can see that sort of on the right there. Yeah. For several decades, the inquisitive and adventurous sons like Rick Irving could explore the old underground rifle range and the underground passageway that once connected the arsenal's boiler house, bullet plant, case plant, machine shop, rolling mill, and storehouse. Rick Irving, as I mentioned a moment ago, managed to salvage a metal hatch once used to cover an emergency exit from the passageway beneath. There he is there on the left of the fact. If you look at this map of the arsenal site, if you look at the top, there's a long line sort of. A venerable old red brick building set back among the trees west of James Street functioned as a storehouse during the wartime years. I think it was a storehouse. And later served as a truck driver's training school. And when this building was destroyed by fire last summer, July of 2022, Court of Lakes this week erroneously implied in its reportage that this long, low building was the munitions factory. And in reality, it was just merely a component of the much, much larger Dominion arsenal. Still, the Vic Line, the only structures still in situ that were once connected with the arsenal, are a post-war office building at the corner of Berry and Elbow Streets, a backward-looking garage immediately south of the latter, where it is there, as seen on Google Maps, and indicated the site plan in 1926, and of course, the old superintendent's residence at the corner of Mary and Lindsay Streets. So how has the Dominion Arsenal been remembered, especially as the physical plant is no more? The cornerstone, laid on July 14, 1916, was removed in 2005 to the Royal Canadian Legion here in town, where it enjoys a place of prominence in the foyer. Brass cartridges manufactured in Lindsay during the First World War were given the headstand LAC, the Lindsay Arsenal Canada, or DAL, the Dominion Arsenal Lindsay, and surviving examples of those cartridges have found their way into museums and into private collections. These tangible reminders of the arsenal are important, yet some of military historians focus on objects, the bombs and bullets, tanks and trucks used on the battlefield, to the neglect of those who had the unpleasant task of making and using them. Reading at the Royal British Legion's Festival of Remembrance in 2017, a young intern from the Commonwealth War Graves Commission made the following point, and I have quite like this. Remembrance is not about the battles or the graves, it's about the people. How then can we remember the people who served behind the walls at the Dominion Arsenal during the two world wars? Between 2014 and 2020, as Ted said earlier, I worked in various capacities at the Victoria County Historical Society's Old Jail Museum here in town. One of the most memorable initiatives with which I was involved during those years was the federally funded traveling exhibit called First World War Comes to Life. Over the summers of 2015 and 2016, this exhibit set up shop in a dozen communities across southern Ontario, into Quebec and the Maritime provinces, and Newfoundland, telling the through costumed interpreters the lesser-known stories of men and women who served behind the front lines during the Great War. Among the stories highlighted by First World War Comes to Life was that of the munitions worker. A young interpreter by the name of Erica Griffin, who's pictured right here, I think Erica is now a teacher at least someone, donned a replica uniform of a Blue Devil and showed exhibit goers how young women of a century before did their bit in munitions factories across the country. And if you can believe it, we used bundles of dry spaghetti to represent cordite. So what you have on your tables this morning is supposed to be cordite. So there, and you can see it sort of more poignant when the Special Service of Remembrance that I coordinated on behalf of the Historical Society to mark the 100th anniversary of Armistice Day on November 11th, 2018. I believe some of you may have read that. Sprinkled in between the various hymns, anthems, and readings of this service were dramatic monologues written and performed by students and a teacher from IU Weldon Secondary School. Among them was student Sidney Warden's reflection on the conflicting feelings of a munitions worker at the arsenal. Here we are, making something that will kill people, and yet this is but a small price to pay for the greater objectives of the war. So with Sidney's permission, I now share the monologue with you. This is very poignant. Every day I work. I wake up early and walk myself down to the factory. Most days, I just go about my business. Most days, I operate a drilling machine. Spend my days drilling holes in powder grooves. But once every so often, they let me paint the cartridge cases. It's not really normal painting, but it is quite fun. Those days are special. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's nothing quite like the thrill of operating a drilling machine. But for some reason, the painting gets me thinking. Every so often, I look down at a cartridge that I paint, and I wonder. I wonder where this one small cartridge will go, and what it will do. I imagine it's dried in boxes, stacked in crates as they're driven down to the harbor. I imagine all those big crates being loaded into an even bigger ship to go all the way across the ocean. It must be frightening for such a small piece of metal. But then I do remember that he has his cartridge friends to keep him company. When my little cartridge arrives in Europe, I imagine that it will be shipped off straight to the battle zone. They need all the supplies they can get down there. Oh, but the war zone must be terrifying for my little cartridge. Bombs going off at every turn, men shouting and running in every direction, smoke goes up in the air, guns go off, men scream for home as their lives are taken. Then a man takes my cartridge out of his box, loads it into his gun. I imagine the sound of the shot as my cartridge is fired, the soft thud of metal piercing flesh, and the sound of the body falling to the ground. My little cartridge kills one of the enemy. For a moment, I just stare at the little piece of metal in my hand. It makes me sad that my little cartridge might one day take a life. That the small piece of metal in my hand that was made by me and so many other women was a cylinder of death. A man might never make it home, might never see his family again because of a cartridge with my fingerprints on it. But I close my eyes, take a deep breath, and think of all the good it's doing. For king and country, they all say, for the suffrage, for the boys in the field, for the children at home. Is it possible that something can feel so good and so bad all at the same time? Think of all the women it's taken to get to this final stage of painting, I tell myself. The welders, the drillers, the inspectors, every single woman that has made this cartridge. Yes, I know the man whose fingers pull the triggers are important, but every woman who works in this factory is prepped so the munitions are ready for the battle. Are just as important. So I get back one little cartridge and last look and put it in a pile in the box, telling myself those fingers did good, telling myself as I walk home that the little metal cylinder of death is doing good. Right after Sidney read the monologue, everyone stood to sing the hymn, "O Day of Peace That Dimly Shines," which is a call to lay down arms in the pursuit of justice, truth, and love. So how then should we remember the Dominion Arsenal? I encourage you to take a stroll past the common sometime and stare through the chain link fence still separating it from Mary and Albert Streets. As you contemplate the desolate, overgrown field in front of you, the piles of concrete, steel, and wood and refuse still lying in different parts of the property, think of people like Lieutenant Colonel Sidney Weatherby and his senior son, who transformed this site into one of the most efficient munitions factories in Canada. But think, too, of people like Elmer Cooper, Elsie Grant, Vera Humphrey, and hundreds of other young women from across this community and beyond, who dutifully trooped into the arsenal to churn out countless numbers of lethal cartridges. And what about William Cameron, James Featherstone, Leonard McClendon, and other toolmakers, machinists, and office clerks? What might have been going through their heads and hearts as they went to work in the service of king and empire? Think, too, of Louis Bennett and all those who lost their lives on account of the killing machines devised by humans. Think, too, of Katie McKinnon and her colleagues, who desperately tried to stop blood from pouring out of the wounds made by these sinister products, whether they were manufactured by us or by them. And as you contemplate the overgrown brownfield in front of you, consider what it might one day become as development proposals roll in. Perhaps there will be homes built here to house the homeless, or gardens to feed the hungry, or perfectly manicured parks to transform a once polluted landscape with roots in wartime into something of beauty, of life, and of new creation. But even as we contemplate what the future holds beyond this chain link fence, we remember what once was and fight to work towards a world in which arsenals are permanently a thing of the past. Lest we forget. Thank you.